History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 51, The Confederates on Boston Harbor. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to discuss the role one of the Boston Harbor Islands played as a prison camp during the American Civil War. Thousands of Confederate soldiers, diplomats, and politicians would be imprisoned behind the walls of Fort Warren on George's Island during the war, as well as civilian political prisoners from border states. Eventually, the fort would become the site of this Union state's only Confederate monument. But before we talk about the Confederates on Boston Harbor, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is October 23rd, and on October 23rd, 1855, the third national exhibition of the United States Agricultural Society opened in Boston. Imagine a fair like the Big E, but instead of being for a group of states, it was for the entire country. A grand national exhibition of stock, cattle, horses, sheep, and swine, open to competition to all the states of the Union and the British provinces, will be held by the United States Agricultural Society in the city of Boston on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, October 23rd, 24th, 25th, 26th, and 27th. The city of Boston has generously granted to the society, for present use, a fine public square of 50 acres at the south end, bounded by Harrison Avenue, Chester, Albany, and Brookline Streets. There were prizes for the different classes of stock adding up to over $10,000.
In the middle of October 1690, a fleet of 32 ships out of Boston, carrying about 2,000 militiamen under Massachusetts Governor William Phipps, arrived at the French stronghold of Quebec. They sent an emissary to the French governor with a tersely worded letter demanding his immediate surrender. The messenger then said that Governor Frontenac had 1 hour to reply and pulled out his pocket watch. One can almost imagine him tapping his toe impatiently. Frontenac was enraged, and it was only because a bishop intervened that he did not have the messenger hanged immediately in full view of the New England fleet. Instead, he gave his response. "I have no reply to make to your general other than from the mouths of my cannons and muskets." For the next few weeks, French militia harassed the Massachusetts forces as they tried to set up a siege line around the city, while French cannons firing from the hills around the city laid waste to the English fleet. On October 24th, after negotiating a prisoner exchange, Governor Phipps ordered the Massachusetts forces to retreat. The defeat of the New Englanders was complete, with nothing to show for the loss of half the fleet. About 30 men were killed in combat, while up to 1,000 died from shipwreck and disease. The governor of New York would lament, "The whole country from Pemaquid to Delaware is extremely hurt by the late ill-managed and fruitless expedition to Canada, which hath contracted £40,000 in debt and about 1,000 men lost by sickness and shipwreck, and no blow struck for one of courage and conduct in the officers." It was not the Massachusetts militia's finest hour.
Wednesday is October 25th. On October 25th, 1848, over 300,000 people gathered on Boston Common for a great water celebration. The Frog Pond was at the center of attention, and as the sun set, dignitaries opened a valve, and a stream of water shot up some 80 feet in the air from the center of the pond. Finally, Boston had found the source of clean water that it had been seeking for over 200 years. Since the first Puritan settlers settled on Boston Harbor in 1630, finding an adequate source of clean, reliable drinking water had been an ongoing challenge. After first settling in Charlestown, John Winthrop and his followers moved across the river and founded Boston because it had fresh water springs. Early Boston's development clustered around one of these springs. Located on the site of today's Spring Street, the townhouse, First Church, and commercial district were all within steps of a fresh water spring. There were additional springs on Boston Common and on the southern slope of Beacon Hill. However, the population of Boston grew rapidly, and these small springs could not keep up, forcing Bostonians to rely on wells of uneven quality and rain barrels. In 1795, Jamaica Pond was tapped with wooden pipes and used for drinking water, but even this source quickly fell behind demand. In the early 1800s, there were many competing proposals to find water for Boston, with sources from the Mystic Lakes to the Charles River. Most suffered from either a lack of quality or quantity. Finally, in 1845, a tributary of the Sudbury River in Natick was dammed, creating Lake Cassituate. A 14-mile aqueduct brought constituent water to the Brookline Reservoir and eventually a waterworks with a massive steam-powered pump. In later years, the constituent reservoir would be supplemented and then supplanted by the Wachusett and Quabbin reservoirs. Today, the Metro Waterworks is a museum, the constituent aqueduct is a hiking trail, and the reservoir is a great park to swim and canoe at. But constituent water served the city for over 100 years. That first day, the massive water festival was opened with a prayer. There were speeches from the mayor, the water commissioners, and other dignitaries. School children sang songs, and the Handel and Haydn Society sang a hymn to constituent water, which went, in part, "Rivers and lakes and springs declare that thou art wise and kind and good. Both man and beast thy bounties share, thou givest drink, thou givest food. Behold, from yonder distant lake, a stream our city now supplies. We bid it welcome, come, partake. Today its waters greet our eyes."
After signing a treaty of amity and commerce with the Dutch, John Adams made his way back to France, where he would soon sign a preliminary peace treaty with the British. On October 26, 1782, he arrived in Paris, after traveling for 10 days from The Hague. The first thing to be done in Paris is always to send for a tailor, peruke maker, and shoemaker, for this nation has established such a domination over the fashion that neither clothes, wigs, nor shoes made in any other place will do in Paris. This is one of the ways in which France taxes all of Europe and will tax America. It is a great branch of the policy of the court to preserve and increase this national influence over the mode because it occasions an immense commerce between France and all the other parts of Europe. Paris furnishes the materials and the manner to both men and women everywhere else. Oh, such a hatred for high fashion. Reason 4,332, why I'm Team Adams for life.
Friday is October 27th. After a decade of urban renewal that saw entire neighborhoods razed and replaced by office towers and strip malls, the Boston Redevelopment Authority was hungry for new projects. On October 27, 1964, a supporter gave a speech in favor of redeveloping the historic Back Bay to a class at Boston College. "The impact of the automobile and the ease of country living have changed the character of the old Back Bay residential neighborhood. We have increased the numbers of people and changed the methods of transportation so that night and day we are harassed by cars, standing still or moving, and by people using old houses for uses which sometimes create high unit real estate values, but damage overall neighborhood values through noise or other nuisance. Certain areas, such as the waterfront and the Central City Business District, have already gone far in producing plans by joint efforts of business and public agencies. Plans for revitalizing and rebuilding centers of great economic vitality have been completed or will soon be. Because of its comparative newness and its obviously dynamic attraction for economic enterprise, the Back Bay could by no stretch of the imagination be classified as ready for standard urban renewal treatment. And yet, the signs of early decay have become obvious to the keen observers of trends. Fortunately, the city came to its senses, and the Back Bay didn't suffer the same fate as other former neighborhoods, like the West End."
John Eliot was an interesting character in the early history of Massachusetts. He had been a teacher in England until he was forced to leave for New England because of his Puritan beliefs. He settled in Roxbury in 1631 and became a teaching elder of the church there. Eventually, he became convinced that he was being called to spread the gospel to the Native Americans of New England. He'd seen other ministers try and fail to convert the Indians, and decided that the language barrier was the primary obstacle. He set out to learn the Algonquian dialects of the local tribes. Eventually, he was ready to give it a try, and he approached the Massachusetts leader Wabon at his home in Nonantum, in today's Newton. Eliot's journal would record, "Upon October 28, 1646, four of us, having sought God, went unto the Indians inhabiting within our bounds, with desire to make known the ways of their peace to them." This was the first time the Massachusetts people had heard a Christian sermon translated into their own language. Eliot saw some success, with Wabon choosing to be converted, along with some of his many followers. In the coming years, Eliot would translate the entire Bible into the Massachusetts dialect, and he wrote books on other Algonquian dialects. In 1651, the colony set aside a new town called Natick to be settled by Eliot's converts, who became known as Praying Indians. Within 2 decades, there were 14 praying towns, and some estimates say that 20% of the Native American population of Massachusetts had converted to Christianity. The Praying Indians lived with 1 foot in each world, in an arrangement that turned out to be unsustainable. When King Philip's War broke out in 1675, the Praying Indians would be confined in internment camps on the Boston Harbor Islands, with little food, no shelter, and few supplies to sustain themselves. Disease, starvation, and winter's cold took their toll. Of between 500 and 1,000 who went into the camps, only 167 survived to be released the following year. While they were gone, 10 of the praying towns were dissolved, and their homes were destroyed. Smaller communities survived into the 18th and even the 19th century, though their numbers dwindled and their languages nearly went extinct.
Finally, Sunday is October 29th, and on October 29th, 1901, police in Amherst, New Hampshire, arrested a nurse who was suspected of murder. Honora Kelly had been born to Irish immigrants in 1857, but raised in an orphanage from the time she was 6 years old. She was placed as an indentured servant in the home of Mrs. Ann Topin when she was just 8, and eventually changed her name to Jane Topin. After being left at the altar at age 19, she studied to become a nurse at Cambridge Hospital, completing her training in 1887. It was while she was at Cambridge Hospital that she developed a sexual fetish for experimenting on her patients with morphine and atropine. She would administer morphine until they were in a near-death state of coma, then give them atropine to revive them. Sometimes, she would climb into their beds and caress them as she repeated this process over and over. Later, she said, "When the climax of my mania passed, I realized what I had done. I have known that my patients were dying. Then, my greatest thought was to resuscitate them. I have then worked over them, trying to bring them back to consciousness. I have sent for doctors and other nurses and tried my best to save them. Sometimes I have been successful, but many times the poison was too much. They were beyond recovery and they died. Despite the list of bodies that began to pile up around her, she transferred to Massachusetts General Hospital in 1889, where she killed at least 3 more patients before being fired for theft. She began working as a private nurse, and along the way she killed more patients, including entire families. She killed landlords that she owed rent to, a friend whose job she hoped to steal, and eventually her foster sister in 1899, saying, 'I held her in my arms and watched with delight as she gasped her life out.' When she was arrested, she confessed to 31 murders, although she was suspected of killing as many as 100 people. A jury deliberated for just 27 minutes before finding her not guilty for reason of insanity. She was committed for life to the Taunton Insane Hospital, and you can learn more in Episode 7.
On that cheerful note, let's move on to this week's main topic. On the evening of October 31st, 1861, the steamer State of Maine made its way slowly across Boston Harbor. The ship was barely seaworthy to begin with, and now it was carrying over twice its normal capacity. There were almost 800 people on board, of whom over 600 were Confederate prisoners of war, recently captured on the battlefield near Hatteras Inlet, North Carolina. 155 more were political prisoners, mostly politicians from the border states of Kentucky and Maryland, who were suspected of sympathizing with the secessionist cause. As they came into the Narrows, George's Island rose up on the port side. On its shores, the tall granite walls of Fort Warren stared back at them impassively. The sight of the fort, and possibly the sensation of a brisk New England breeze on a fall night, left these Southerners unenthused. One of them would later describe Fort Warren in a letter home, saying, "A more desolate place could not be imagined anywhere this side of the Arctic regions." As impressive as it may have looked from the water, Fort Warren was not ready to receive this massive influx of prisoners. The commandant of the fort, Colonel Justin Dimmock, had been told to expect 100 political prisoners, so he didn't have sufficient beds or supplies for an initial arrival of 800 men. Beyond that, the fort itself wasn't even finished yet. A Massachusetts general would describe the state of our coastal defenses at the outbreak of the war. the casemates were unfit for human occupation. The grounds inside the forts were covered with workshops and wooden shanties, and instead of being a defense to the city and harbor, the fortifications of Boston were a standing menace to them, and invited seizure by the enemy. The entire coast of Massachusetts was open to attack from the sea. Not a fort or an earthwork or a gun was in proper condition. Fort Warren had been under construction since 1833. After the War of 1812, Congress realized that the nation's coastal defenses were in need of a serious upgrade. They appropriated funds for a series of coastal forts that reached from the Penobscot Bay in Maine to the Mississippi Delta near New Orleans, and eventually up the Pacific coast to San Francisco. It wasn't the first time George's Island had been fortified. As early as March 1776, just weeks after the British evacuated Boston, John Adams wrote to Abigail saying, "I can think of nothing but fortifying Boston Harbor. I want more cannon than are to be had. I want a fortification upon Point Alderton, one upon Lovell's Island, one upon George's Island, several upon Long Island, one upon the Moon, one upon Squantum. I want to hear of a half dozen fire ships and 200 or 300 fire rafts prepared. I want to hear of row galleys, floating batteries built, and booms laid across the channel in the narrows. No efforts, no expense are too extravagant for me to wish for to fortify that harbor so as to make it impregnable. I hope everybody will join and work until it is done." Fortifications were thrown up on Long Island and on Governor's Island, and the fort at Castle Island was taken over by the Patriots. In 1778, our French allies constructed and garrisoned an earthen fort on George's Island. Their artillery helped to protect our harbor and the French ships that often moored there.
Beginning in 1833, Fort Warren was designed, and the construction was overseen by Colonel Sylvanus Thayer, who was known as the father of West Point. It was designed as an irregular pentagon, using most of the surface area of George's Island, and named after Joseph Warren, hero of Bunker Hill. The original construction could mount 200 guns, dominating the narrows between George's and Lovell's Island, which at that time was the main shipping channel into and out of Boston Harbor. There were 42 similar forts along the nation's coasts, and it's perhaps a good thing that the Civil War combat never came to Boston Harbor. Fort Warren's sister fortifications in the theater of war saw their masonry walls smashed to gravel by the newly invented rifled cannons in use by both sides during the war. The fact that Confederate soldiers were held as prisoners of war in the northern states won't come as a shock to anyone, but the idea of imprisoning civilian politicians, especially those from states that still belonged to the Union, might be a surprise. The political prisoners who arrived in that first batch were mostly from Maryland. George Proctor Kane had been chief of the Baltimore police force, and Baltimore was a hotbed of Southern sympathizers. When the 6th Massachusetts Militia, the first from our state to answer Lincoln's call to arms, passed through Baltimore, they were attacked by a mob. As the troops attempted to change trains, they were met with rocks, bricks, and pistol shots. It was April 19, 1861, anniversary of the battles at Lexington and Concord. 4 Massachusetts men were killed and 36 were wounded. Marshal Kane led a group of his city police officers to form a buffer between the mob and the soldiers, arguably preventing worse violence. However, his fate was sealed by a telegram he sent that night to secessionists outside the city. Streets red with Maryland blood. Send expresses over the mountains of Maryland and Virginia for the riflemen to come without delay. Fresh hordes will be down on us tomorrow. We will fight them and whip them or die. Since he was already known to support secession, this was the last straw. He was arrested by federal troops and initially taken to Fort McHenry. In Fort McHenry, he was joined by a rogues gallery of Maryland secessionists. Among them was Francis Key Howard, who published a Baltimore newspaper that was strongly in favor of secession. He was also the grandson of Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner while watching the British bombardment of the fort the younger Francis was now locked up in. George Morgan, Clark Durant, and other state legislators were also there, after their plan to set up a secret legislative session outside the capital city of Annapolis in order to pass secession was discovered. By the time they were moved to Fort Warren, half the state Senate and over half the House of Representatives was behind bars. They would jokingly refer to themselves as Maryland's government in exile. On George's Island, they were met by prisoners from Kentucky who were in a similar situation. Among them was Charles Moorhead, the former governor of Kentucky, who had tried to negotiate neutrality for the state during the Civil War. Later that year, the notorious Mason and Slidell would be brought to Fort Warren. James Murray Mason and John Slidell were so-called diplomats, dispatched by the Confederacy, who were sent to Britain and France to seek military support for the rebellion. In order to stop them, the captain of a Union steam frigate intercepted the British mail ship RMS Trent that they were traveling on near the Bahamas. He fired a shot across her bow, boarded her, and seized Mason and Slidell as prisoners. They were locked up at Fort Warren by mid-November. The Trent affair caused an international incident and nearly brought Britain into the war on the side of the Confederacy. To avoid this outcome, President Lincoln ordered the two men to be set free, and on New Year's Day, 1862, they continued their voyage toward Europe.
At the tail end of the war, a month after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, Union troops arrested the vice president of the Confederacy at his home in Crawfordville, Georgia, on May 11, 1865. Alexander Stevens was an unlikely choice for vice president. He had spent the decade before the war in Congress fighting to keep the Union together and prevent the South from seceding. He had even endorsed the Missouri Compromise of 1854, calling it the greatest glory of my life. Even at Georgia's secession convention, he urged his fellow delegates to stay loyal to the Union. Once the die was cast, his state sent him to the Confederate Congress, and he was selected as their vice president. In March of 1861, he gave a speech on the nature of the Confederacy that puts to rest the idea that it stood for states' rights, or nobility, or anything other than slavery. Our new government is founded upon exactly this idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. After this cornerstone was undermined and ultimately destroyed by federal troops, Vice President Stevens arrived in Boston Harbor on May 25, 1865. He kept a detailed diary of the 22 weeks he spent as a guest on our harbor. Upon arrival, he was insulted that he was met by a junior officer and not the commanding general of the fort. "I expected we would go to General Dix, but was disappointed. Lieutenant Woodman of the fort met us at the landing. To him, I was turned over. Lieutenant Woodman brought me immediately inside the fort. After going through the sally port and descending some steps, he stopped at the first room to the left, saying, 'This is your room.' I asked if I could not see General Dix. I wished very much to see him about sending word to Linton and about my diet and conditions of prison life. He said, 'No,' and left. I surveyed the room. A coal fire was burning. A table and chair were in the center. A narrow, iron, bunk-like bedstead with mattress and covering was in a corner. The floor was stone, large square blocks. The door was locked. For the first time in my life, I had the full realization of being a prisoner. I was alone."
In 1865, things had improved enough that Stevens could only complain about the insult of not meeting General Dix. However, when the first shipload of prisoners arrived in 1861, there was still construction equipment and debris on the parade ground, and none of the 200 guns were mounted on the battlements. Before long, the garrison would be whipped into shape, and the fort would be an important training ground for Union units, especially artillerymen, on their way to the battlefields in the South. That first night, none of that had been accomplished yet. Most of the prisoners were forced to spend that first night aboard the State of Maine, sleeping in 3-hour shifts because there wasn't enough room for all of the men to lie down at once. Still sounds like better conditions than the Amistad. In the morning, the prisoners were taken into the fort. The political prisoners were ushered into cells to the left of the main gates, and the prisoners of war to the right. The political prisoners tended to have more spacious quarters, But even among the soldiers, officers and others who could afford to pay were given cells in the officers' quarter. The rest were quartered in barracks rooms measuring 17 feet by 50. Most of the cells were unfinished at first, with no accommodation but the bare granite floors. Dimmick's orders said that the Confederates were to be treated with all kindness, but it would be weeks before adequate beds and bedding could be obtained, to say nothing of sufficient food for the unexpected number of prisoners. The plight of these prisoners on our harbor was carried in many Boston newspapers. The Boston Post would say, "Our citizens should contribute liberally with things as are needed," and soon donations were rolling in. Bostonians donated food, bedsteads, mattresses, blankets, medicine, clothing, and books to the enemies on their doorstep. Some of this generosity was driven by the spirit of charity, while some was an attempt to inspire similar kindness toward Union prisoners being held in the South. As the Boston Daily Journal said, "The friends of our prisoners now languishing in the South will reach them by the shortest method if they set an example of magnanimity toward these rebels. The fact will soon become known at the South, and their hardships will be lessened." Along with the charitable donations the prisoners were receiving, those with the means to do so could purchase the comforts of home. They soon established trade with the merchants of Boston, and they had sumptuous meals, alcohol, and cigars shipped in. The officers and political prisoners were given broad freedom to roam the island as long as they promised not to attempt to escape. After the initial shortages abated, life among the prisoners on George's Island became relatively comfortable. One of the Maryland legislators would describe their conditions. "Within a few months, we have had, during the day, the free run of the island, some 40 acres, and at all times in a walk, there is some moving thing to be seen on the waters, and still more lately, we have been allowed to fish and to trap for lobsters. We have from May to November a steamer twice a day from Boston with the papers. The friends and families of several of the prisoners have had permission to visit them. Mrs. Frank Howard has been, for 3 months, to visit her husband every day if she likes. She did come for about a week, and she may return again. Even the most lowly private with no money to buy himself the luxuries of life would enjoy the same food and the same barracks conditions as a Union private stationed on the same fort. Of course, for some, that was little comfort, as letters home would complain of the stench of codfish and onions coming from the Union mess."
Conditions at Fort Warren may have been pretty cushy by prison standards, but it was still a prison, and men still attempted to escape. One Confederate captain named J.W. Alexander would later recount how he and an accomplice escaped from Fort Warren in 1863 and almost made it to freedom in Canada. Four of us determined to escape. Many plans were suggested and discussed, but none seemed feasible. Indeed, situated as we were on an island, strictly guarded day and night, with sentinels stationed in front of our doors, confined within solid masonry constructed to resist the shot from the heaviest guns, it seemed impossible to escape. And yet the escape was easily accomplished. In the basement, under the room in which we were confined, was a pump where we obtained our water. And in the outer wall of this basement were two openings called musketry loopholes. These were something over 6 feet high, 2 or 3 feet wide at the inside of the wall, and gradually sloping to a point, so at the outer side of the wall they were only a little over 7 inches wide. One day, while bathing, the thought struck me that I could get through this hole. Captain Alexander found that if he stripped naked, then turned his head as if he was looking over his own shoulder, he could squeeze through the gap. It took 3 attempts for him to get off the island. Outside the walls of the fort, the conspirators discovered that it was easy to evade the Union sentinels. As the sentinels walked toward one another, they would lie still in the island's tall grass. When the sentinels met and turned to walk away from one another, they would crawl forward until they were over the seawall. They would then lie still in the water with their heads propped up on the base of the seawall and their bodies hidden underwater. The first time out, they realized that there were no boats that they could easily steal, and they ended up sneaking back into their cells. The second time, they took along 2 Confederate sailors who were strong swimmers. They repeated the process, and the 2 sailors swam to another island to find a boat. and they never came back. The third time proved to be a charm for Captain Alexander. This time, he and one accomplice went into the water themselves. They found a wooden target used for riflery practice, and used it as a float to help them swim across the Narrows and then out to Boston Light. There, they stole a small boat, but by the time they made it back to George's Island, the sun had come up, and their remaining two accomplices had been captured. Turning north, they sailed their small craft toward the main coast, hoping to eventually make it to neutral New Brunswick. Along the way, they went ashore at an isolated house near Rye Beach, New Hampshire. The laconic New Englander they found listened calmly as two naked men with southern accents explained how they came to be in a small boat with cut anchor lines off the coast of New Hampshire. We told him that we had sailed out from Portsmouth for a lark and had gone in bathing, and that while in the water, our clothes had blown overboard. And we asked him to get us some clothes if he could and bring us some water and something to eat. He went on shore and soon returned with some old clothes, a good supply of plain food, some tobacco, and a small bottle of cherry brandy. I am satisfied he knew what we were, but we said nothing except to thank him for his kindness. On the third day, a revenue cutter found them. They were taken to Portland, and soon found themselves back at Fort Warren.
This story of escape seems to have inspired the persistent legend of the Lady in Black. According to this tale, a Lieutenant Andrew Lanier of Georgia was imprisoned at Fort Warren in 1862. Learning of his fate, his wife Melanie made her way to Boston, cut her hair short, and donned men's clothing and infiltrated George's Island. She signaled her husband, and he lowered a rope to allow her to climb in through one of the loopholes. She had brought a pistol and a pickaxe, and the plan was to tunnel into the fort's arsenal, arm the prisoners, and overpower the garrison. Unfortunately for them, the noise of the digging alerted the guards. When they rushed in to arrest the conspirators, Melanie sprang out with her pistol drawn. In the confusion, there was a misfire, or perhaps a ricochet, or some other accident. Her bullet struck her own husband, and he fell dead. She was sentenced to hang as a Confederate spy, and in her grief, her only request was that she be allowed to dress in mourning for her husband. Accordingly, a long black gown and veil were procured, and she wore them to the gallows on George's Island for her execution. Well into the 20th century, soldiers and visitors at the fort would claim to see the apparition of a woman in black roaming the parapets or stalking through the basements under the casemates. This story is, of course, complete hogwash. There are no recorded escape attempts from Fort Warren prior to 1863, and importantly, no prisoner, male or female, was ever executed at Fort Warren. In fact, the only woman executed as a spy during the Civil War was Mary Surratt, who was hanged for her role in the conspiracy to assassinate President Lincoln.
The story of the Lady in Black may be an invention, but that doesn't mean that the prisoners at Fort Warren were immune from death. When the first prisoners arrived in 1861, dozens of them brought typhoid fever with them. Base doctors immediately went to work trying to contain it, but typhoid, dysentery, and the other diseases of soldiers in close quarters would plague the fort on and off throughout the war. A letter from a Union doctor records that the diseases most prevalent at Fort Warren are typhoid fever, mumps, pneumonia, bronchitis, rheumatism, scabies, and debility, the result of previous sickness. After several cases of smallpox were discovered among the prisoners, base doctors realized that most of the Southerners had never been vaccinated. They scoured up a sufficient quantity of the vaccine and had it administered to the prisoners. In all, 13 prisoners died at Fort Warren, out of a total of about 2,200 who were held there during the course of the war. That's about one-half of 1%, as compared to about 12% who died at the average northern prison camp, and 15% who died at the average Confederate prison. Up to 35% of Union prisoners died at the notorious Andersonville prison camp in Georgia, where they were held without adequate food, access to fresh water, or appropriate sanitation. In comparison, the prisoners held at Fort Warren suffered a lower casualty rate from disease than the average unit of soldiers on either side of the war.
In 1963, the United Daughters of the Confederacy erected a small stone monument on the parade ground inside the walls of Fort Warren. The UDC were enjoying their heyday during the centennial of the Civil War, erecting monuments around the country, even in former Union states. Their ideology treated the cause of the Confederacy as right and just, minimized or ignored the role of slavery in the Civil War, and promoted the idea that the Confederacy was a heroic lost cause to defend the Southern way of life in the face of Northern aggression. Their special brand of memorialization enjoyed a boom in the South in the early 1960s, as monuments to Confederate glory were seen as a way to push back against the growing success of a civil rights movement. Here in Boston, the monument they erected seems relatively benign. It lists the names of 13 Confederate prisoners who died at the fort beneath a seal and inscription. Upon closer inspection, however, a few things stand out. The Great Seal of the Confederate States of America tops the granite slab, complete with the Latin motto, Deo Vindice, which translates to, Under God, Our Vindicator. Below that, the inscription reads, During the War Between the States, 1861 to 1865, more than 1,000 Confederates were imprisoned here, of whom 13 died. This is a commemoration of 13 specific men at the prison camp in which they died. Among them is a Private Lanier, supposed husband of the Lady in Black, who died of typhoid in January 1862. As such, it's a more fitting memorial than many of the martial statues of Confederate soldiers and generals sprinkled around the South. However, that use of the Confederate seal and the reference to the war between the states, a phrase used by Confederate apologists to imply that the Civil War was a quarrel between a collection of autonomous states, rather than an attempt to preserve the American Union, turns even this simple marker into a piece of propaganda.
After the Charleston church shootings by Dylann Roof in 2015, communities around the country considered removing or reinterpreting their Confederate monuments. As the movement gained momentum, city crews in New Orleans wearing bulletproof vests, helmets, and masks to hide their identities removed that city's Confederate monuments in May. Mayor Mitch Landrieu delivered an eloquent, touching address in defense of the decision.
So before we part, let us again state clearly for all to hear, the Confederacy was on the wrong side of history and humanity. It sought to tear apart our nation and subjugate our fellow Americans to slavery. This is a history we should never forget and one that we should never, ever again put on a pedestal to be revered. As a community, we must recognize the significance of removing New Orleans Confederate monuments. It is our acknowledgement that now is a time to take stock of and then move past a painful part of our history. Anything less would render generations of courageous struggle and soul searching a truly lost cause.
In June, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker issued a statement through a spokesperson indicating that he would support removing the memorial at Fort Warren, our Commonwealth's only Confederate monument. We should refrain from the display of symbols, especially in our public parks, that do not support liberty and equality for the people of Massachusetts. In August, the nation was shocked as a demonstration that had been advertised as opposing the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee turned into one of the largest, most publicized, and well-organized white supremacist rallies in living history. The shocking images of neo-Nazis marching by torchlight and heavily armed right-wing militias menacing synagogues in Charlottesville led to a national reckoning with the subject of Confederate monuments. Just days after a counter-protester was killed in Charlottesville when a white supremacist drove his car into a crowd of people, a descendant of one of the Fort Warren prisoners, described as a coal shoveler on a Confederate steamboat, wrote, "Well, if the input of a descendant of one of the 13 Confederate dead has any weight, Massachusetts, I say take it down. Why? For starters, it was put up under the auspices of the Daughters of the Confederacy, and the less you have to do with those myth-making coots, the better. But more importantly, the monument is injected with the same poison that blights our fate as a country. The conceit that God had any part of the foul business of the Confederacy, and the insinuation that there was anything remotely honorable or noble about the cause it represented. So take it down, Massachusetts. you have the blessing and encouragement of this descendant of the dead, but more importantly, you have the moral imperative of the living, and a responsibility to those yet to be born.
Within days of the violence in Charlottesville, the monument at Fort Warren had been encased in a wooden crate, out of view while the state and federal agencies administering the Boston Harbor Islands decided what to do next. Finally, on October 2nd, the Secretary of State's office announced that the monument will be removed from Fort Warren and transferred to the Commonwealth Museum in Dorchester, saying, "When the marker is removed, DCR will transfer it to the state archives for storage until it can be returned to the people who placed it on the island. It will remain in storage until then and will not be on display." There's no word on the final disposition of the marker. If you'd like to visit Fort Warren, there is regular ferry service to George's Island from mid-May to early October, with departures from Long Wharf in Boston and the Hingham Shipyard. Be sure to allow for enough time to explore the extensive public areas of the fort, with history from not only the Civil War, but also our coastal defenses during both World Wars. Bring a picnic to enjoy on the island, or pick up lunch from the snack bar on site. Be sure to bring a flashlight to explore the fort's underground tunnels and hidden chambers. And don't forget your sunscreen.
To learn more about the Confederate prisoners in Boston, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/051. We'll have a link to Confederate Vice President Alexander Stevens' prison diary, a number of sources on the civilian prisoners held at Fort Warren, and that letter from John Adams wishing for forts to be built on Boston Harbor. We'll have information on the debunked Lady in Black ghost story, and we'll have links to contemporary news articles on the debate around removing Boston's Confederate monument. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week with the story of Radicals Angela and Ezra Haywood.